Hi Tim.
Hi, Brian.
How are you? You look well. I can see your face.
Yeah, we're first ever time trying this Zoom recording, and the best part about this is that you seem to have some sort of double down that is like it's almost like it's eating you. Like the background, there's like cheese coming through your teeth, your glasses are filled with fried chicken. It's quite I think I could get used to recording like this.
It's the way of the future, and Zoom is just laughing in their socks. Is that a thing? They're laughing all the way to the bank, because obviously
Yeah.
we're in the middle of coronavirus lockdown. So we're recording a couple of different episodes via Zoom. So that the my background is indeed a picture of a KFC double down burger, and that's a bit of a sneak preview for a couple of episodes in the future, I think. But it was interesting because I think last year, or after we had the episode with Helen Yee from Grab Your Fork, we planned a couple of episodes, and then we put it off for a while, and then when COVID came around, these top three topics actually were strangely relevant to COVID times. So yeah, it's going to be a topical, somewhat topical. Couple of podcasts that we're recording. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Topical, but we're not just going to bum you out. I think like there's a lot of podcasts out there at the moment that are, can get a bit depressing. So these will be topical, but we'll, put a smile on your face, maybe some drool coming out of your mouth, So that's the goal. But
Yeah, we've.
it's been a long time. I don't know, a long time overdue. Because, yeah, I. We did speak after. Have we spoken since I got back from Vietnam? I think so.
Maybe, maybe not. Yeah, so you went, when was that? That was late
That was
2019
last.
or mid
Yeah, late
2019?
20. Yeah, mid to late 2019. I just left and went over there, out of frustration after having a back injury that just kept getting worse and worse. And I thought, you know what? If I'm going to be in pain, I'm going to head over to Malaysia and Vietnam and just eat my way through the pain. It's pretty much what I did. I just ate some of the best food for 4 weeks that I ever could. And I guess like for this first episode, it is interesting to mention Vietnam because we're going to be talking, war and food. I suggested the witty title of War and Greece. I don't know which one's better, but I guess Vietnam is a country that when I went there, you're reminded about the Vietnam War everywhere you look. Like, I saw some exhibitions that, just showed the horrible aftermath of the war and the impact of things like Agent Orange and different chemicals that they had on the Vietnamese people and just the trauma that the Vietnamese people and, that everyone involved in that war went through. But then, I don't know, I was walking around Ho Chi Minh City and seeing that stuff. But then you're surrounded by some of the best food in the world. And it just seems like no matter the trauma that these people have gone through, they still turn to food and are able to find such joy out of food. And I guess that's something that we're probably all doing right now during COVID as well, is turning to food in a time of stress. But it did just get me thinking about the impact that, I don't know, that wars have had on cuisine and the impact of trauma and stuff that has had on cuisine. And I guess because I traveled to Korea as well a few years ago, and obviously that's a place that the food has been so impacted by war and the Korean War, and their cuisine, as we know Korean food today, has changed completely from what Korean food was before the war. So yeah, I thought that'd be a pretty fun thing to talk about today because it's just a topic that I just don't think we realize just how much war has impacted the way we eat.
Yeah, I think it goes for a lot of society. Unfortunately, it's the way of the world that a lot of money goes into the military and into military engineering and science, and they often get the coolest shit first, and then it kind of flows onto the civilian world after that. So That's definitely been the case with food. But yeah, just going back to Vietnam, tell me more about the delicious things you ate, because I think obviously Vietnam is one of our favorite food cuisines, but what were some delicious dishes?
Well, it was hard to be honest, because I did 2 weeks in Penang in Malaysia, which is one of the most famous food destinations in the world. So I would even say probably my food highlights were mainly in Penang. But in terms of Ho Chi Minh, where I spent 2 weeks, I did eat a lot of, I had daily banh mi, which was really good. And interesting, I did notice with the banh mi there, the quality of the bread was way higher than what we get here. Like, we have such good banh mi here, but the bread there was the star of the banh mi. Probably much more than the actual fillings and ingredients. I think the fillings and ingredients we in our banh mi in Australia is pretty good, but the bread was such a star of banh mi. What else did I eat?
I was just going to mention with the banh mi, that kind of reminds me of the dynamic that happens in Italian food with pasta. It's like traditionally pasta is all about the noodle, the pasta itself, and then the toppings or the meat sauce is kind of just a vehicle for it. And I feel like that's kind of similar to how it is here. You know, in Sydney, we're so obsessed with the fillings and, who has the meatiest ones, or it feels like it's quantity over quality sometimes, although it's pretty good quality, but it's very much in that kind of burger, massive burger trend. You know, you want that packed out sandwich. But I feel like certainly in the videos that I've seen, a lot of the banh mi's in Vietnam are super compact. There's not as much filling, and it's more specialized. So it's a really interesting cultural difference.
Yeah, definitely. It was definitely like everything, the bread was just better. It was much simpler. It was like the, just a classic American cheeseburger where they don't fill it with crap, but everything on there works together. So that's what I found. Because I think sometimes here with, like you're saying, with burgers and banh mi, everyone's trying to overdo it, and sometimes the balance of everything gets thrown out. What else did I eat? I ate a lot of, I'm so bad, to be honest, the names of Vietnamese dishes and the Vietnamese language is something that I struggle with.
It sounds like a particularly hard language.
Very, very hard. I ate quite a bit of pho, but there's a different, I can't remember the name of the dish, that one I actually ate more, which is more it's a beefier and more chili-based broth.
Is it bong bo hue? Is it like got a lemongrass kind of flavor with pork trotters and stuff on top and some kind of meat?
I did eat that. No, this is more, it's more just like a stew. It's more like a stew, and often everyone on the streets there dips the soup with bread. And I just drank tons of coffee. I just had such a good time. It was one of the most intense cities I've ever been to. After a few days, I just got really used to it. Maybe I didn't see as much influence left in the Vietnamese food by the war as I did when I was in Korea. Like, I know when I was in Korea, it's just everywhere. Like, for example, I guess the most famous example is army stew, which is like, we've eaten it out before, but if you haven't eaten it, if you're listening and you're going, what's that? It's because when the Korean War ended, Korea had serious, they were in like almost a famine. The food supply was completely destroyed. But one thing they were left with was tons and tons of Spam from the US Army. So it's just a sign of, this seems to happen around the world, but where people are able to turn what some might consider an average ingredient into something delicious. And I think we've talked about this in previous episodes, but this dish where they combine Spam, spicy kimchi, instant kind of ramen noodles, and it's this salty, savory, delicious dish that is so much fun. I think you often get slices of processed cheese in modern editions as well, but it's a dish that made use of the leftover war ingredients and turned it into something amazing. And so that's, a perfect example of the impact that a war has had on changing a cuisine. And I think in a positive way, it's a really fun dish that people in Korea really treasure to this day. And even the likes, I'm thinking back to Korea again, like the likes of fried chicken, that was something that everyone now associates with Korean food. But that was, you know, really made popular because fried chicken came over with the US Army and Koreans really took to it and have now just kind of made it their own. And some people, you know, it's their favorite style of fried chicken. And yeah, a bunch of other ones like putting mayonnaise on everything, like so much Korean, modern Korean food has mayonnaise on it. And that was the same thing, stuff that was left by the US Army. So yeah, I'm sure Vietnam has had that impact. Like I'm sure maybe more Vietnam, it might be more the stuff you're mentioning, the technology that the US Army used might have influenced how food that we eat here in Australia and food in the US. Like I think it was like, isn't it like Cheetos or Cheezels or something like that was US Army technology from the Vietnam War? Like,
There's a book that was written about, I guess the impact that military food has had on civilian food. I guess going right back, so canned food or canning came about in part to a French government competition to help feed Napoleon's army, which is pretty interesting. So my history is so bad, but Napoleon was ages ago. Wartime innovations in blood plasma transport paved the way for instant coffee, which is pretty incredible. And as you mentioned, the dust on Cheetos, like the flavoring, can be traced back to a dehydrated compressed jungle cheese invented by government scientists in 1943. So it's pretty amazing. It's kind of sad that we have to, you know, rely on war and, you know, terrible catastrophes to give us phenomenal things like Cheeto dust. But yeah, it's good we end up with it. Do you have a favorite canned good in particular?
Oh, I'm going to give you this the most boring response. The having a canned, like a tinned tomato, I know it's just, but I just rely on tinned tomatoes. It's my oh my God, what am I going to cook? And then I just see that tin of tomatoes and I'm like, ooh, that's going to be like make a shakshuka, make a tomato pasta. You know, there's so many uses for the tomato. But in terms of novelty ones, I don't know. I think there's just so many. I was in the supermarket yesterday. I braved it to go in these COVID times. I went to the supermarket to have a look. I ended up with a tin of Spam here that I might, you know, start eating in the middle of this podcast. Spam blows my mind.
It's great.
People can process a meat and put it in a tin. That's just something else.
But what strikes me about Spam is that it gets so much hate. But to me, it's not that far from like some pretty fancy pâtés I've eaten in restaurants. Like it's obviously not as sophisticated, but texturally and even how it looks, it looks like a terrine, like a rough kind of French terrine or something. But yeah, pâtés. Spam is wonderful. My favorite way of cooking Spam or corned beef in particular is corned beef stir-fried with Chinese cabbage. That's what my mum used to cook for us. And it's insanely delicious. And, you know, you're pairing traditional bedfellows, you know, a ham product and cabbage. The love for Spam should never cease, in my view. I've been getting into sardines a lot recently. I'm not sure why. I think, for health reasons, it's really good for you. You know, high levels of omega-3, which are very good for your mental health, which we'll talk about, I think, in the next episode. But there's a bit of a movement. I've read some articles talking about how canned fish kind of gets a bad rap because obviously in Europe, canned seafood and canned fish are really revered. They're seen to be almost like the charcuterie of the sea. So like you get a beautiful prosciutto or a salami or something like that, canned seafood and sardines or clams, they have the same the same reputation in Europe. So I've been really getting into the sardines. There's a great blog that reviews like every single brand of sardine that you can get, which is really hilarious. And recently I made kind of a bastardized version of a Portuguese dish called bacalhau ao Braz. So the original dish is salt cod, which is a dried salted cod, which you rehydrate, and then you cook with French fries and eggs and onion. But I've done like a bastardized version with canned sardines and, you know, French fries, like the Smith's French fries chips. I've used that instead of French fries. Yeah.
Arguably on a completely different topic, I was having I have even had this conversation with you about top, you know, five packaged chips.
Oh.
And I brought this up with my girlfriend Beck, and she chucked French fries in there. It was an absolute curveball. So yeah, big shout out. And I actually have to I've just got to, while I think of it as well, I've got to give a shout out. I know we don't usually do shout outs in podcasts, but just made me laugh. My friend Tully has an obsession with tinned mussels and tinned oysters.
Oh,
like absolutely! He like apparently eats like 10 tins of them a week. And the craziest thing he made me was he made a dip out of them.
Oh yes!
Like he I can't remember what else was in there. I'll have to find out from him. But he like chucked them all in like a blender.
Oh yes!
With like oil, and I must say, pretty damn good. Like it was quite something else.
But that's the thing. Like whenever you have something with such strong flavors, so like a pickled mussel or a smoked oyster, you blend that into a dip or a compound butter even, or anything just to cut the richness, and you're just going to get a beautiful nuanced product at the end. So, I mean, yeah, you've told me about Tully for years and years. Hopefully we can get him on at some point and I can fall in love with him.
Yeah, we'll get the secret dip recipe and find out about his... Yeah, he's like a master of making hummus that he just transferred out. He just chucked some tinned oysters and mussels into that blender instead. Hey, you were telling me a bit earlier, and I want to hear more about it. Like, you've got a list of what the different armies around the world get fed. Like, because I don't know, in my head, I presume that armies, if you're in the army, you kind of eat like crap. Like, you eat, I don't know, just processed shit. But now I'm starting to think, like, maybe they're just eating like cheesels like all day long. And for me, that sounds like a dream. Well, what's the list? What country's winning in this regard?
Well, there should be a competition for like the best army food. But you know, it's a hugely important factor because, I think the quote from Napoleon that, that an army marches on its stomach or something like that. But it's the same with astronauts. They've realized that if they don't feed the astronauts properly, that they won't function, that their mental health suffers, and then they won't be as effective. So I think the same thing happens for armies. But to take a bit of a world trip, in Italy, they provide a breakfast shot of a 40% alcohol called Cordiale. I guess it's like an aperitivo. They also have a powdered cappuccino, I guess, for afterwards, and lots of biscotti, which is, seems logical. In France, you get deer pâté, you get a cassoulet, which is like a stew, I guess, with duck confit, Creole-style pork, and a cream chocolate pudding. And in Singapore, you get Sichuan noodles, you get a mushroom basil, and rice dish, and then you get a soy milk and red bean dessert, which is pretty killer. I guess that the big thing for the American army was making pizza. That was the biggest, the most requested item, but it's the item that has struggled the most, that they've struggled the most with to innovate. So did you read any more about that? Or
I think it was in that same book you were mentioning about how the military has influenced the way we eat. But I did read, I think she was saying like in terms of, there was an interview with the author and they asked her, you know, what future innovations, like what is the military currently working on that's going to change the way that we eat? And it was really interesting. Like she was saying that the big things that they're still working on are shelf-stable pizza. Mm. So a pizza that doesn't need to be refrigerated. It's just like can sit inside your cupboard all day. And she was saying that's, you know, that's what the military is working on, because I think what the idea for like the military, the US military, for example, in the future, is that everything will just be shelf stable. Everything can just be left out all day. There's no need for refrigeration. And it'll kind of just be like the soldiers can just nibble on things all day rather than having to have meals and things like that. So she was saying, you know, that's probably the thing that'll influence us most is that maybe in the future we won't even have a need for refrigeration. Like everything will be shelf stable. Like they're working on shelf stable sandwiches, and you know, so I wouldn't be surprised if in the future when we go to buy a pizza from the supermarket, you don't go into the refrigerator aisle. It's just in the, you know, just in aisle two. So
it better be like Back to the Future 2, where you just like rip open the tiny foil packet, you put it in the oven, and boom, you get a steaming hot pepperoni pizza. That is like one of my favorite food scenes of any movie. It's just the most miraculous thing. I mean, the thing where you pull down from the roof and you get the herb garden, that's pretty rubbish. But the instant cooking pan pizza is, yeah, it's amazing. Do you know the scene I'm talking about?
I'm going to have to go back and rewatch this.
Okay.
I think it's also, it's a perfect movie to be watching during isolation. Like, you know, get to travel back to some different times, go into the future. So I'm going to go watch that. And I don't know, maybe it probably makes, I don't know if the actual, like the reality of being in isolation and the way we're eating, is it as romantic and as appealing as that? That sounds pretty amazing. You know, being able to pull, like I'm in my apartment and I've got my herb garden. I don't know. Mine hasn't been that appeal. Mine hasn't been quite that good.
Yeah. I think we've got to be careful about, you know, thinking about what's good for the military and for a soldier, and then what's good for real life, because yeah, they're not the same. And so we don't necessarily want to translate everything about how the military eat to what we do. Obviously, yeah, and we'll cover this more next episode, is that there's so many rituals and mindfulness that comes with cooking and with preparation. And so much of what makes food great is not just about nutrients and intake. So, I'll happily eat, you know, a space food stick or, you know, have my instant coffee, but you know, sometimes it's nice to cook, to, you know, to grow your own tomatoes and cook them and take that time. So yeah, life kind of feels a bit like a war zone now, but, you know, it shouldn't be like that all the time.
And how have you been going with, have you been doing some doomsday prepping?
I'm actually just looking. I'm looking at my stockpile right now. It's an interesting process, because you've got a kind of meal plan for a month, right? And think about what you'd eat every meal, which is not something you'd usually do. I mean, Adam Lior, who, he won MasterChef, ages ago, but he's obviously like a food writer and, a TV show producer, talked about how, you know, especially now that we've kind of flattened the curve, stockpiling is not really necessary. And how, you know, this rush for flour or, you know, these specific items is actually kind of, it's not really necessary. Our lives aren't dramatically different than what they were. But it has been interesting kind of, kind of bringing back some kind of staple dishes and thinking, okay, what would I find comforting to eat? Or what, you know, I'm sure beans and lentils have become much more commonly cooked now. Yeah, how have you gone with stockpiling?
Well, it was interesting because we were, I was moving house as this was all happening. So I kind of having to fill up a pantry with basic essentials, which were suddenly very hard to find. Mm. So, but yeah, it does just make you realize how privileged we are. And it is a tough, this is like one of the toughest times that we're probably going to remember, but our access to things is, you know, there's still so much choice on supermarket shelves, even with a bunch of things sold out. And I think I was watching a TV show the other day, recommended by Beck, my girlfriend, and now I think it's called Super Size Go or something like that, where they go and back in history and eat the diet of a specific time. And there was a really interesting episode about, it was called Wartime, and they went back and ate the rations that were given to the British population during World War II. And nice. That really put it into perspective about the difference between, you know, how we're living now and how they're living then. Like, I think I wrote it down here, like their allowances, you know, for the average adult in the UK was allowed to have 113 grams of bacon and ham a week, so about 4 thin slices, 1 shilling and 10 pence worth of meat, which is about 227 grams of minced beef, about 50 grams of butter, 50 grams of cheese, 115 grams of margarine, 113 grams of cooking fat, 3 pints of milk, 225 grams of sugar, which seems like quite a lot of sugar for 1 week, actually, and 50 grams of tea and 1 egg. So, I don't know, that doesn't seem like much, and it's not much variety. But as this show showed, once again, in a tough time, innovation came about. You know, people got really innovative with what they had to work with. Mm. And I found this amazing website that really shows this off. And it's a hilariously dated website that, you know, definitely some flaming text would be right at home on. But it's called the 1940sexperiment.com. Mm. And it's run by a lady who's attempting to lose weight by eating wartime rations. And for every pound she loses, she posts a new wartime recipe. And it's so amazing. Like, some of the recipes, the ones that I scrolled through that were highlights were mock goose, which was made from lentils, breadcrumbs, and sage. Mock duck, made from sausage, meat, apples, onion, and sage. And, she also made Anzac cookies, because I guess that was maybe an Australian example of a bit of wartime innovation, you know, because that's what Australian soldiers were given, often, you know, by their wives, or they would post them, and they, you know, an Anzac cookie is kind of like, you know, it could survive a nuclear war. Yeah, they just last. So... that's just, I just loved that. Like, again, like those rations sound, I reckon a modern day population in Australia or in the UK would not cope with that. We're so spoilt now. But it shows you in that time when people were going through such a hard, you know, hard time and really having to ration what they were eating, they still managed to try some pretty interesting things and to have fun with food.
And I think that kind of, tells a really interesting story about the human experience and about creativity as well. Dave Chang, the patron saint of this podcast, talks about when he started his restaurants in New York and how there was so little space. It was just a galley, like a very narrow kind of corridor where they could cook and eat. But those constraints actually inspired him and forced him to be more creative about service. So instead of having waiters, the chefs would then serve the food to the diners themselves, obviously looking at cooking equipment and having to pre-cook things and finish them, you know, a la minute. So I think, well, I mean, obviously COVID is a terrible, terrible catastrophe, but there is a sense that it will give us a sense of a rejuvenation, I guess. I mean, obviously, you know, lives are lost and that's truly horrific. But I've thought about it like a bit like a bushfire. You know, you have terrible destruction and loss. But at the end of it, you know, there's evidence that after a bushfire, there's a sense of rejuvenation and the soils are cleansed and new life grows and new kind of evolutions happen. So I think that's the silver lining of this whole experience. And also some research suggested that through times of communal stress, like a world war or a natural disaster, people actually become more cooperative, more social, and more friendly. From a scientific perspective, that's kind of about a collective survival mechanism. You know, we all have to band together to get through this. But, you know, I think we've seen some beautiful examples of people supporting each other, being kind to one another, and being charitable. So, yeah, I mean, war, I think, brings nations together, but I think something like COVID can bring the world together, because we're all so intimately connected, and this is so striking. We are just incredibly connected in our very microbial, is that a word? In our microbes, we are connected to one another, from here to Africa to Asia. We're all just so connected together, and that nothing else in recent memory has made me feel more connected to everyone else. So I think it's a real humanitarian moment that we can try and bond together, and hopefully not, you know, have fights over tissue paper. But that's Brian, kind of understandable too.
can you see the tears in my eyes through Zoom from that beautiful monologue? The best part about that beauty, like, that was absolutely, like, everything you said just, like, struck me. But the best part of it is that you still have this double down as your background. This is a politician I could get behind. Just, like, it's constantly being a double down and just speaking truth.
See, this is, ScoMo didn't need to pay empathy consultants. He just needs to put a picture of a sausage sizzle behind him on every speech, and he would be so much more relatable.
Oh, so but I guess the one thing we are missing out on in this is being able to actually go out to a restaurant and eat, or go out to a cafe. And that is something I am missing, because I can make, I roast my own coffee. I've worked as a barista in the past. I can make coffee as good as I like it, but that doesn't replace the social interaction and the joy and the, you know, my favorite part of going to a cafe is the actual experience of sitting down there and building a relationship with the barista or the owner of the cafe. Mm. And the same with restaurants as well. It's, you know, getting delivery. I've been doing it a little bit, but it doesn't really bring the same amount of, anywhere near the amount of joy of going into a hospitality establishment. Mm. And, you know, that is an industry that is really struggling right now. I'm so excited when this is over to get back out there and go and explore restaurants and pubs. Oh my God, I can't wait for a pub meal. That's something that can't be, like a Parmigiana and a scooey. Is there something is there a restaurant or a specific food that you've been craving, that you're excited to go back to when this is all settled down?
I mean, I had my usual kind of list of restaurants that I wanted to go to. So I really wanted to go back to St. Peter, which is like a fish restaurant that's using kind of a meat attitude to cook with fish. So they just released their degustation, so I was keen on going to that. Yeah, I'm going to go check out their, they're doing some takeaway stuff. So I might head on that way to grab some of that. But yeah, just the usual stuff, like just going down the road to the local Korean restaurant, or going to my favorite fried chicken places. Luckily, Lim's Hot Bread is still open at Eastwood. So, yeah, that's like the first restaurant I thought of, or the first establishment I thought of when COVID was first kicking off about who I wanted to give money to. But as you said, it's just that day-to-day stuff, right? It's being able to have a picnic with friends and, just being able to connect. So, so the time will come.
Oh, I can't wait. Maybe we can end this with just a big shout out to Lim, to the Lim family. It's just like Lim's Hot Bread Eastwood. It's been mentioned on the podcast over and over again, but that's a place that would bring every single person in the world a bit of hope right now. Just go and visit the Lims and buy a bar me.
Yeah, and that's it. It's they're just wonderful people, and you always feel great when you go in. You feel like you've known them forever. It's a wonderful thing. So cheers to Lim's Hot Bread.
Cheers, Lim. But yeah, so good to be doing this again, Brian. I hope it sounds all right. I hope people can hear us, but it's the best that we're working with what we've got.
Look, our podcast is so professionally produced and stunningly amazing every week. So no doubt we're going to lose a whole bunch of listeners after this episode. But, you know, we'll survive. We'll be resilient.
And next episode, what are we talking about?
I think originally we were going to talk about the senses and food, but I think we're going to pivot and talk about mental health and emotions and food. Obviously, coronavirus is a super stressful time. And we've kind of touched on bits and pieces of well-being today, but yeah, taking a deeper dive into food and mental health. But also, we're talking about how we can stay well and how we can still experience moments of joy when things are pretty hectic. So hopefully everyone keeps well until the next episode.